Okay, so this is lesson two of our class. Well, actually, this is not lesson two. This is lesson two, but we're doing second part of lesson one. We're still in the review of Jewish history that we need to do before we get into Jewish evangelism. And the reason why we need to do a review of Jewish history is because when we try to reach out to a people, any people group, when we try to reach out to a people group, we need to close the door because I hear some sound from the outside, and I don't want that to go on the recording. When we try to do outreach of any people, we need to know about that people. We can't just walk in and start talking. There are things that are going to be in the way. Of our outreach if we are not aware of culture and custom. So that's why we're doing this review of Jewish history. And of course, if you remember, for those of you who took the class on anti-Semitism, Jewish history and the history of anti-Semitism basically go hand in hand. It's a parallel study. You can study either or at the same time. You really can't separate the two. So we talked a little bit last week about, we did an introduction, the early Jewish history, and we had stopped basically. I put a little marker. We stopped at the, it was like the first century, right? As we're getting a little bit into the church fathers, and we're not going to spend a tremendous amount of time because if you need the notes on that, they're still available on the Hadavar website of all the quotes from the church fathers and all the different things that that we already went through. In the other class, so we talked about the gathering of the Mishnah and the Gemara and the making of the Talmud last week. That was where we stopped in the middle of page 5 of your first lesson, and then right after that, I put a definition of anti-Semitism in there. It's one of many. There are many good ones, but I only wanted to put one because we just want to keep going here. The definition is anti-Semitism is a hatred of the Jewish people as such, characterized by destructive thoughts, words, and or actions against them. And the reason why I wanted there is because for the next session, maybe the next two sessions, as we go through a brief, quick overview of Jewish history, we did this in like 20 sessions in the class on anti-Semitism. We're going to be doing this in like 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours. So as we go through the history, it will be punctuated by acts of anti-Semitism, and we cannot be properly equipped in Jewish evangelism if we're not aware of what has been done to the Jewish people and all the different levels of anti-Semitism. So it's part of the foundation. So by the second century, we're like on the middle of page 5 now, by the second century, most believers are Gentiles and are becoming increasingly unable or unwilling to relate to Judaism. The issue becomes the validity of Judaism. Now, we're not quite yet into the physical harm of the Jews, killing or kicking them out of different countries. It's more of a theological difference at this point, but it's going to develop into something much worse as we go through the centuries. Many of the early church fathers will take a stab at establishing dialogue with the Jewish community at the beginning. They want to try to establish dialogue. They will learn Hebrew and some of the Jewish traditions, but ultimately they're only succeeding in widening the gap. Now, what's interesting is the early church fathers desired to study the Old Testament, the Tanakh. They were serious, not all of them, but many of them were serious about it. They quickly realized that their best teachers could be the local rabbis who knew the Talmud, who knew Hebrew, who knew the Old Testament. So they went to them, and they got together, and they learned Hebrew and the Hebrew traditions and a lot of the Jewish practices from the local rabbis. And with that, they acquired a method of interpretation of Scripture that was an allegorical method of interpretation of Scripture. And it not all the time, but many of the rabbis had an allegorical interpretation of the Bible that gave the church fathers a non-literal approach to what they were trying to understand, and then also give them put them in the habit of using those methods when they did the New Testament. And this is the beginning of a developing of a method of interpretation that led to more allegorical approach to Scripture and led to replacement theology. That's how we... I don't want to say that rabbis were responsible for replacement theology, because that would be a big stretch, and I don't believe that. But, you know, that's how it kind of got started. On page 6, I list... four different kinds. I'm not going to read this because I really want to get going here, but I list four different kinds of approach to rabbinic exegesis known as Peshat, Remez, Derash, and Sod. And those four are listed there, and all the rabbis were using some or one, preferably sometimes two combined, to look at scriptures. But the rabbis would almost always favor one over another. They would use one or two sometimes. Nevertheless, rabbinic schools of thought started to develop over the centuries, and as a result, different interpretations of the Hebrew Scriptures were made available. Not only the Church Fathers received possibly different interpretation from literal to mystical, but inevitably, they also started to adopt some of the exegetical methods of their teachers and continued to interpret Scripture using their own most favored method of interpretation. So at this point, we only have theological anti-Semitism or theological anti-Judaism. There's no harm. We're looking at the first couple hundred of years, the early church fathers here. But I want to give you a list. We're on page 7 here. A list of, and a much more more comprehensive list is available in the other class on the head of our website. Some of the key players with their birth date and, you know, their when they were alive, in parentheses there. For instance, Justin Martyr wrote one of the most infamous, it's like a booklet or a pamphlet, a little book called Dialogue with Trypho, and it was a dialogue he had with a Jewish rabbi, and they were going back and forth, and in it, I just pulled one quote: "Tribulations were justly imposed upon you, for you have murdered the just one." So we see the beginning of the accusation of deicide, the accusation of, you know, killing Christ killers. And with, this is early now, we're looking at 100 to 165. Next one is Tertullian. Again, there are a lot more. I picked the big ones. He wrote a book as well known as De Adversus Judaeos, Against the Jews. And in it is anti-Judaism. We cannot even call it anti-Semitism quite yet. It's really anti-Judaism as a religion, as a theological belief, so to speak. It's purely ideological. He obviously got some of his inspiration from earlier works by Justin Martyr, and he very methodically uses the Hebrew Scriptures to disprove the relevancy of the Mosaic Law, and prove that all blessings to ethnic Israel are now passed on to the other nation, i.e. the Christians. So now we're looking at, you know, middle of the second century, we start seeing a shift from ethnic Israel to the church being the new Israel. Now, it's not labeled replacement theology or supersessionism, as the fancy word for it, but it's starting to happen, and it's only going to get worse. And of course, that it's only theological, but then it's going to evolve, and it's going to just basically, that theological fallacy is going to fuel the human nature and the desire of those who hate the Jews to actually do more against them, and they will feel, in a sense, that they are, it's like a divine validation. It's validated in the Bible, it's taught from the pulpit. I'm only doing what I'm supposed to do. If I'm told that the Jews are, God has done with the Jews, hey, I'm just going to go with that. I like the idea. So that's what's happening. Of course, the next one, John Chrysostom, still today considered one of the greatest of all church fathers of all time.
Mm-hmm. So all these church fathers you're referring to were Gentiles?
Yes, they were. Yes. And but we're not going to hold that against them. There's other things we can hold against them. just kidding. John Chrysostom is still considered one of the greatest of all church fathers. He was a famous preacher. Known as his nickname was the golden-mouthed orator. Apparently, he was one of the greatest preacher of his era and of Christendom for many, many centuries. Most of what was written against the Jews by previous church fathers is dwarfed by Chrysostom's contribution. He hoped to show the Jews and the synagogue in their true colors, according to him, of course, to discourage Christians from engaging in relationship with Jewish people and even attend synagogue services. Next is a quote. It's one of the most famous quotes by him. The synagogue is worse than a brothel. It is a den of scoundrels and a repair of wild beasts. The temple of demons devoted to idolatrous cults. The refuge of brigands and debauchees and the cavern of devils. It is a criminal assembly of Jews, a place of meeting for the assassins of Christ. A house worse than a drinking shop and a den of thieves. A house of ill fame, a dwelling of iniquity. The refuge of devils, a gulf and an abyss of perdition. I would say the same things about their souls. As for me, I hate the synagogue. I hate the Jews for the same reason. Men who are lustful, rapacious, greedy, perfidious bandits, inveterate murderers, destroyers, men possessed by the devil. They have surpassed the ferocity of wild beasts, for they murder their offspring and immolate them to the devil. You know, I wish he would really tell us what he thinks about the Jewish people. He I don't want to drop the microphone. That's not good. He was really, really vocal about the Jewish people, and yet, in the Catholic Church, he's still considered one of the greatest. So, of course, Catholics might not necessarily know exactly what he wrote against the Jewish people. You know, a lot of people are ignorant of all those things. Yet, the Jewish people are not. The Jewish people know more about the church fathers and all those quotes that I'm sharing with you, and Martin Luther and all those things that happened, than Gentiles or Christians or Christendom in general. So that's why we need to know. Because if you want to earn the right to speak and have a dialogue with a Jewish person and share the love of Messiah, you must know those things. So we'll keep moving. Otherwise, I'm going to repeat the class I just already done. And we have so much to cover. Next one is Augustine. What happened at the same time here that you need to know is that until 325, this is not in your notes, until 325 AD, Jews and Christians celebrated Passover around Resurrection Sunday. They celebrated Passover at that time together. And Passover being a feast of the Bible, the Christians didn't have a problem with it. I mean, they believed in Messiah, but they had no problem with Passover. But at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, it was put to an end, and which was not the reason why the council was convened and organized, but it was put to an end, and that's one of the things that they had to stop. Many more would come after that. But 354 to 430, Augustine, contemporary of John Chrysostom, and he was unique in the fact that his treatment of the Jewish people reflected a certain ambivalence. Augustine saw the Jewish people as a witness people, which was a concept that he had come up with to explain their survival through the ages while suffering greatly. So he was not really anti-Jewish in a sense like Chrysostom, but he was comfortable with the idea that, you know, the Jews still exist today because they have to continue suffering for what they've done to our Lord. That's the concept of the witness people. They're not, they still exist, they're not going to die, they're not going to be completely eradicated because they need to continue suffering for what they've done to the Lord, which is ludicrous. It's just ludicrous, which is not even true. Of course, we know that. You can read those quotes that I have put there from Augustine. Then the Roman Empire and Constantine. We're in 272 through 337. Roman Empire began in early to mid-first century. During its peak, the Roman Empire controlled approximately 2.5 million square miles of land surface, and because of its spread and duration, it had a profound and lasting influence on a lot. On the development of language, religion, architecture, philosophy, and even law. The Western Roman Empire collapsed in 476. The Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire ended in 1453. Constantine was a great military achiever. He was able to reunite the Roman Empire under one emperor. In 315, Constantine published the Edict of Milan after publicly claiming to be a Christian. Until then, of course, most of you know that Christianity was the enemy of the state. And now it became one and the same with the state, and the persecution of Christians by the state came to a stop. This was a big deal. It was good news for the Christians. But usually when it's good news for the Christians, it's never good news for the Jews. Okay? And so it's also during Constantine's reign that the cross became the official symbol of Christianity at that time. when you wear a cross, it's always a little puzzling to Jewish people when you wear a cross, because some Jewish people have told me they don't understand why I would wear, it's like wearing an electric chair, a little golden electric chair around my neck. You know, why would you wear a method of execution as a symbol of, well, I mean, there's pros and cons. You know, well, this reminds me of what the Lord did for me. I mean, I personally don't wear one. I have nothing against the symbol behind the cross. I personally never wore one. I wear a Star of David or a mezuzah around my neck. I recommend that if you talk to Jewish people, you probably don't want to have a cross out or a pin with a cross or a T-shirt with a cross, because it's distracting at the very least and offensive to most Jewish people. So,
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So you know how Paul, he said that if he boasted anything, it would be the cross. But I understand also, I mean, I've been yelled at. You can't witness to a Jewish person with a cross on, you know. So definitely
When Paul, you have a good point. You have a good point. That's why we're not ashamed of the cross and what it represents. But when Paul was saying that, how much of Christianity had transpired from the cross to Paul? Very little. Look at today. Look at how much has transpired of Christianity, and look at how much of it was used against the Jewish people using the symbol of the cross. So there is a difference. I agree with you, but because of the 2,000 years of anti-Semitism, today we can no longer say, well, Paul used it and claimed it and praised it. We should do the same. We have to be careful. Culturally, there's been an increase of misuse of the cross.
Paul That's didn't wear it, though.
No, yeah, but wearing it was not something that they did back then. They didn't wear a cross, or even a fish or. Right.
Because most of those people that are Catholics, just like I was,
right,
they were not right.
Right.
I mean, there's no need to wear that.
Well, plus Catholics, they wear a cross. They wear a crucifix. They wear a cross with Christ dead on.
I had them both ways, with and without.
Oh, really? Because
most
Catholics I've ever met always had a cross with the Jesus on it. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, we're getting this is our favorite thing to do in this class is sidetracks and rabbit trails. Yes, we love them. That's why it takes 6 months instead of 2 weeks. Okay. So after he came to power and made Christianity the state-approved religion, he did not repress heathen practices. His leanings for a more pagan Christianity are clearly shown in the result of the first ecumenical council at Nicaea, which I just mentioned to you. And I list here, why they got together, and then the fact that at Nicaea they said, you know what, we can't relate with the Passover. It's so many of us, so few Jewish people. Let's just come up with something else. I mean, that's not the way they said it, but that's the way they did. And Ishtar, the Easter was introduced, most likely from the fertility goddess of Ishtar. Now I'm not gonna go on a witch hunt against Easter, but I don't like to celebrate Easter. I celebrate Resurrection Sunday, because the reason for the season is the death and resurrection of the Messiah. So You know, when people talk about Easter, I just don't get into it because I get bigger fish to fry, you know. But I just, you know, I don't do it. I just don't, you know, it's not part of, but I recognize that the time on the calendar, because without the death of Messiah, without the resurrection of Messiah, his death is pointless. And, you know, he's just like all the other false gods. He died and that's it, but he came back. That's a big deal. So that's very important. So at that time, under Constantine, and it's going to start developing more and more, laws come into effect. Under his rule, middle of page 10, under his rule, laws began to be passed against the Jewish people. They were only the starting point of a long strain of judicial streamlining aimed at controlling, ostracizing, and eventually annihilating the Jewish people. A few are listed here. There's many, many. Death penalty for the circumcision of slaves. Jews were forbidden to own Christian slaves. Death penalty for embracing the Jewish faith. Death penalty for Jews versed in the law who aided them. Death penalty for marriages between Jews and Christians or for attending Jewish religious assemblies. It was dangerous for both sides. A lot of Christians were forbidden to do a lot of things that they were doing before with the Jews, as well as Jewish people were also forbidden to do their own thing. Constantine's measures against the Jews were comparatively mild, yet they announced the end of the toleration that Jews had enjoyed under the Roman Empire. Until that time, the Jew was sort of a second-class citizen, somewhat protected by law, but tolerated. The same concept of that we have under Islam, known as the dhimmi, D-H-I, it's in the text actually, D-H-I-M-M-I. A dhimmi is a people of the dhimma, or people of the contract. It's anybody under Islam who's a non-Muslim, subject of a state governed in accordance with Sharia law. So a dhimmi is a lesser citizen that's protected by...
Protected non-Muslim
and has to pay a tax. Same with the Jews. Up to that point, they were kind of like protected by law, but just tolerated. But it's changing. At this point, it's changing and it's getting worse.
Okay, but the understanding with the dhimmi established was that protection could be withdrawn at any time.
Sure. Okay. And the protection would vary depending on who was given the protection and how they got out of bed that day. But you know, we don't want to go into Islam. We'll get into that later. We don't want to get into it now, but that's I agree with you. Paul's advice to Gentiles in Romans 11 to provoke the Jews to jealousy was ignored, as the Jewish people were provoked to anger, not jealousy. Okay, so that's we're gonna keep cruising here. This is where we were supposed to start tonight. So this is part two of the brief review of Jewish history. We're still in the medieval period, and 5th to 15th century, anti-Semitism. It's missing a S in the notes here. Do you see that? Don't tell anybody on the recording, okay?
What?
Anti-Semitism is missing a S in the title.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, just don't tell anybody. The Middle Ages is the historical period that followed the Iron Age, and it begins in the 5th century, ends in the 15th. Theological Christian anti-Judaism, coupled with pagan anti-Semitism, would prove to be an explosive mix for the Jewish communities of Europe. We start seeing a lot of codes. We talked in detail about the Theodician Code and the Justinian Code in the other class. The first one was started in the early 4th century, and the other one, the Justinian Code, early 6th century, both very damaging to the Jewish people. Popes and bishops succeeded one another only to make Jewish communal life increasingly difficult. Those codes where they would add more and more laws, and some would enforce them, some wouldn't, some would change them, some would make their own. I have, again, in right there, another list of laws. We're not going to go through all of them, but this is what's happening. We have the early church fathers in a nutshell. The early church fathers are taking a wrong interpretation of Scripture, looking at the church having replaced Israel. And they start, they see that God has changed is focused on the people, and he's giving his favor to the Gentiles, to the church, and no longer to the Jews. So if that's the case, we have to make sure that that's the church fathers, you know, a summary of the church fathers' thinking. We have to make sure we protect our communities from anything that the Jewish people could do that could damage our belief system and Christianity as a whole. So first, after this interpretation of Scripture, thinking that the church has replaced Israel and the Jewish people, now the church fathers start to develop codes and laws against Christians breaking them, and mostly against Jews, to force them to be less and less, to tolerate less and less of their practice of Judaism and whatnot. And those laws first are put together, but eventually the people start looking at those laws and they say, okay, if the Jewish people have been replaced by God and they're dangerous, we have to really make sure that we follow those laws. So now we have the people hearing from the pulpit, the church fathers and the preachers and the popes and all the leaders of the time, telling them who the Jews are and what they are doing, what they shouldn't be doing. So more and more laws are added and less freedom for the Jewish people. And it's going to keep evolving to the point of course, the 20th century Holocaust. So this is the beginning of a very difficult time. For the most part, the medieval period, bottom of page one of lesson two, the medieval period was a very dark and difficult time for the Jewish people, although there was some respite during some, you know, like the 700 and the 1100, different dynasties. But Jewish life even improved a bit, just a bit, under Charlemagne, the French emperor in 800, as Jewish people were included in Charlemagne's entourage and they were well treated. He found no difficulties in preserving the growth and well-being of Christianity while maintaining a decent relationship with the Jewish community of his kingdom. It's also at this time of history that some great Jewish minds come onto the scene that are going to not only change the face of Judaism at that time, but they are going to this day, they are going to make an impact on Judaism that is felt to this day in the Jewish community, that we need to be aware of. When I talk to an Orthodox Jewish man or woman, an Orthodox Jew about the Bible, I most likely will be getting a response based on the interpretation and the commentaries of one or two of those rabbis that I'm going to tell you about in a minute. The first one is, the two rabbis are Rambam and Rashi. Now, rabbi, the all the key rabbis of Judaism, the big ones, not all the smaller ones, but the big ones, they all get their names made as an acronym. For instance, you see here, Rambam is also known as Maimonides or Moses ben Mamon. But his nickname, everybody refers to him as Rambam, and it's Rabbi Moshe ben Mamon. And you take the first letter of each word, Rambam, and you make an acronym. And so Rambam was famous, a famous medieval Jewish philosopher and one of the greatest Torah scholar and physician of the Middle Ages. Born in Spain and died in Egypt. He was a rabbi, a physician, and a philosopher. He published a 14-volume body of work known as Mishneh Torah, meaning repetition of the Torah, that continues to carry authority as a codification of Talmudic law today. He also produced a Guide to the Perplexed to elucidate the Torah. I have a copy of the Guide to the Perplexed. Let me tell you, it is not elucidating anything. I am more perplexed after I read a page or two of this book than before. But it's an interesting title, The Guide to the Perplexed. It's to help people understand the law, understand the Torah. So according to him, You wrote it to promote the true understanding of the real spirit of the law, to guide those religious persons who, adhering to the Torah, have studied philosophy and are embarrassed by the contradictions between the teachings of philosophy and the literal sense of the Torah. So it's you know, from it starts from a good there's a good motive behind it, but it's very very complicated to follow. Like any page of the Talmud, there's a lot of different. You're talking about rabbit trails here. I mean, it's very complicated. Rambam is also remembered for having contributed his famous 13 principles of faith to the Jewish community of his time. And even though they were first criticized by many, they eventually became widely accepted and still considered the cornerstone of Jewish religious life today around the world. About Moses Maimonides, which is his name, Rambam, Moses Maimonides, it is said in Jewish... in a Jewish community, from Moses to Moses, there were none like Moses. From the Moses of the Torah to Moses Maimonides, there are no other Moses. So he's a big shot. Next page, we will not read them. I'll just have them for you in the notes that will be also available on the website, of course, as a PDF, are a list of the 13 principles of faith listed by Maimonides. I like principle number 12. I believe with perfect faith. They all start the same way. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he may tarry, nonetheless, I wait every day for his coming. So, of course, we believe in the second coming of the Messiah. But back then, you know, you have to understand that that's something that you need to start putting in the back of your mind as you will talk to Jewish people. Not every Jewish person you talk to is awaiting for the coming of the Messiah. We await the return of the Messiah. I'm not even talking about Jewish people awaiting the return of Messiah. I'm talking about Jewish people that we always say, well, we Christian, we wait the second coming of the Messiah, and the Jews just are waiting for the first coming. Many Jewish people today, they don't even expect the Messiah to come. Maybe a messianic age, maybe a betterment of the world if we all hold our hands and sing Kumbaya, I don't know. But they don't even expect a person to come and make a difference. Many. So a good rule of thumb when we share with people, in our case we're talking about sharing with our Jewish friends, a Jewish family, a good rule of thumb is find out where the person is on their spiritual quest. Everybody is on a different place, in a different place on their spiritual, on the spectrum of their spiritual quest. Some people are just starting to question the existence of God. Some people don't believe in God. Some people believe that God exists. They just don't know who He is. Some people know that God is real, that He's done things in their life, and they even think that the Bible is written by God, who inspired men to do so. But it's confusing because they don't want to believe that Jesus is God. So there's different places on that spectrum. And we cannot assume that somebody, simply because they look religious, that they're going to believe in God. You'll be surprised. So you have to ask people, you know, I mean, when I talk to people, I say, do you believe in God? If they say, well, no. Well, then, what's the point of saying that Jesus is God and He's the Messiah? I'm way ahead of the game. It's like trying to put icing and you haven't even baked the cake. You can't do that. So we have to really find where that person is on their spiritual quest. Yes?
Would it be best to start off with, do you believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?
I wouldn't even go there. I would just say, do you believe in God?
Yeah, but, you know, that could be many different things.
But what if they say no?
Well, that's okay.
But if they say no, then you have to back up. You have to. But if they say, well, yes, I do, then you can follow up by saying, so you believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's part two of the same question. But I would not even. You might confuse somebody by asking the God of Abraham. Do you mean like
you
God of Abraham, the God of?
You're not going to make anything.
That's right. That's right. But you have.
And maybe the Lord will lead you to do that.
Right. But you need to know. Yeah. You need to know where the person is. Otherwise, you just can go on a long conversation. The person will be polite and shy, and they're not going to say anything. And they're going to look at you like with glazed over, and they're going to go like, I have no idea what he's talking about, and I don't even agree. And then you go like, so what do you think? I don't believe in God. Oh, so from the beginning, you got to ask the big questions. You had a question?
There's a popular misconception that if a Jewish person has been bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, that, you know, in the eyes of the non-Jewish public, these people know everything about the Torah,
right,
everything about scriptures, everything, they learned all these. So, I mean, how can you discuss anything with these people when they know so much more than everybody else? But the truth of the matter is,
when I was first introduced to the Bible and to the Messianic prophecies by my, back then she was not, but she became my wife, she led me to the Lord and became my wife. When I was first introduced to all that, I did not know Hanukkah from Isaiah. I didn't know the difference. I knew nothing. Yet I was Jewish, and like you said, very, very true. In the eyes of many, it's like, oh, you must know Hebrew. You must know the Old Testament. You must know the Talmud. I knew the words. I knew what the word Hebrew means. It's the Hebrew language. I knew what the Talmud is, some kind of a book that nobody understands. And but I knew nothing. Zero. And that's a lot of Jewish people today. I would say three-quarters of the Jews in the world are very little knowledge of all those things. This is not a criticism. It's a fact. You know, we need to know that. Yes. Well, I think, you know, with Jewish people, you know, it's hard with Jewish people because there's so many things have been done in God's name and in Christ's name against them that there's going to be a lot of block. If somebody tells you in general, I don't believe in God, you can't really go anywhere from there unless you get the person to at least admit that God might exist. Then you can start building on that. And I think I did that in the other class. Did not do that circle. Did I show you that circle? It's not gonna go real well on the recording because I'm showing you. They can't see it. But let me explain to you. It's a very quick little exercise that anybody who tells you I'm an atheist, God doesn't exist. Have you met these people?
Oh, yeah.
God doesn't exist. I'm gonna show you a way. It's gonna take. I didn't come up with it. Okay, this gentleman by the name of Kenneth Boa. He's a great apologist, came up with several books when he has this thing at the beginning, and I use it all the time. It's a great way, in 5 minutes or less, to make an atheist into an agnostic. The person enters the room saying, God doesn't exist, and exits the room, if he's honest, saying, you know what? I can't tell you if he exists or not. Honestly, I don't know. It's possible. I don't believe in God, but it's possible he exists. It's a big shift, a big shift. Here's what you do. Take a piece of paper, you draw a circle, and you ask your friend about a couple of things that you know that he might know, but you're not going to know. Something very specific, knowledge of some sort. So you say, the circle, let's assume that this circle represents the entire knowledge of the world. On that piece of paper, napkin, whatever, the entire knowledge, everything that can be known in the world is in this circle. Your friend might say, well, that's not possible. Say, let's assume that this circle keeps all the knowledge of the universe. I'm going to put a couple of things that I know that you don't, because they belong there. For instance, do you speak French? Well, no. Well, I was born in France. I have the knowledge of the French language. So in here I put French. That's knowledge that I have. And let's say I know how to make very good crème brûlée. Can you do that? No. Okay, so I'm going to put the... You want to keep a little bit of a little bit of a light side to it so you can keep the person going with this. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. So, crème brûlée. By the way, this is my favorite dessert in case you need to ever buy me some. Okay? Crème brûlée. Okay, so I have the knowledge of French and I have the knowledge of crème brûlée, including its spelling, which is a French word. Okay, now tell me something that I have no knowledge of, but you do.
Geophysics.
Geophysics? You're right about that. Okay, so you have the knowledge of geophysics. Okay, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Okay, now give me another one. A hobby that you have that you know would be really, or so, no, I do that too. Yeah. I got quite a collection. Something odd. Oh, somebody else. Just give me another one. Something very odd that you know I'm not going to know. Geophysics was a good one, but you know.
Genetics.
Are you okay? Genetics. All right. So this is, you look at your friend. This is all the knowledge in the universe that's available. I have the knowledge of French. Do you have it? No. But it's there, though. Oh, yes. Okay. I have knowledge of crème brûlée recipe. Do you know that? No, I don't. But it's there. You don't have the knowledge of it, but I have it. Thus, it exists, right? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, you know geophysics and genetics. I don't. I have zero clue. But the fact that I don't know anything about it, I don't agree. I don't disagree with you. I don't argue with you. You have that knowledge. It's obvious. So they all four exist within the realm of all the knowledge of the universe. Right? Well, yeah, sure. Okay, let's add one more. You don't believe that God exists. I believe that God exists. I have the knowledge of the living God. You don't have the knowledge of the living God. It doesn't mean he doesn't exist. After all that you've went through with what he knows and you don't, what you know and he doesn't, that person cannot honestly say, no, that's wrong. If they're honest with themselves, they'll say, well, I guess you're right. I guess I have to say that God might exist, I just don't want to believe in it, or I don't believe in him. So that's very simple, and it always works.
That's good.
Okay, well, you know, I've shared with a lot of people, and it's really not part of tonight, but you always get me going. But it's a good one. So, okay. Now, if you leave it this way, and you don't tell the next person looking on the board, they're going to go like, what is this? Crème brûlée, God and genetics. Okay. Yeah, we might want to erase that anyway. Okay. So you have to know where the person is on their spiritual quest. That's where I was. Well, on the lesson for tonight, we were talking about the rabbis of the around the 10th century. The first one was Rambam. The next one, even more so, not so much more so important, but used in many ways today. His real name was Shlomo Yitzhaki, also known by his acronym as Rashi or Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki. You see the first letters of each word. It makes the acronym Rashi. You might have heard the name Rashi in passing in conversation. He was a medieval French rabbi. He probably knew how to make crème brûlée too. Was famous for the first comprehensive commentary on the Talmud, as well as a very thorough commentary on the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible. Within worldwide Judaism, he is considered to be the foremost commentator. So much so that no religious Jews today would consider studying the Torah or the Talmud without his commentaries. So they're included in every edition of the Talmud since 1520. And of course, his approach was a literal basic interpretation of the original text known as Peshat. And you can go back to the notes of last week's lesson about the four different interpretation of the Bible from the rabbis. Both Rashi and Rambam were influential within the Jewish community during the Crusades. That's the time where they lived during the Crusades. Not a happy time to be Jewish, as they were involved in trying to counteract a Jewish conversion to Christianity. For the Jewish people, aside from the Holocaust, it is very difficult to find a year more fateful than 1096, the year of the First Crusade. Some of the most violent and bloody massacres in Jewish history are about to take place, and some most indelible marks in the history of the church. Now, going back to Rashi, before I get into a brief paragraph on the Crusades, Rashi, today, when you talk to Jewish people, if the Jewish person is religious, from conservative up, conservative, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, if they study their scripture, they're going to be Jewish people who are reading the Old Testament, almost always, actually always read the Talmud with it, and attach sometimes, if not most of the time, more importance to the Talmud than they would to the Torah itself or the Tanakh. And that's, of course, this would never include the New Testament. But when they go in Europe, when they go to Hebrew school, they call it Talmud Torah. They go to, where are you going? I'm going to Talmud Torah. And, you know, once a week, the kids go to Talmud Torah. It's not even I'm going to Hebrew school. I'm going to Talmud Torah. And they put the word Talmud first in the description of where they're going. Yet the Talmud is just a series of commentaries by sages and wise rabbis, but it's not inspired. Rashi, when he wrote his commentaries, he was doing it as a reaction to what was happening to the Jewish community and the forced conversion of the Jewish people during the Crusades. What happened is that Rashi took all the messianic prophecies that we are familiar with, and he is the one who reinterpreted all the key prophecies, changing the object of the prophecy from Jesus to Israel. You know, when you talk to Jewish people, sometimes they tell you, well, it doesn't talk about a person, it talks about Israel. It talks about the Jewish people in Israel. And you look at it and you go like, most Christians would go like, oh, I didn't know that. And of course, based on the assumption, the false assumption that you shared with us earlier, he's Jewish, he must know Hebrew, he must know everything, and then we don't. So, okay, have a good day, bye. Well, actually, it's not true. If you go back to the Hebrew, there's plenty of impossibilities in the language. That part we will do some in the Messianic Prophecy section of this class. We'll go through the Messianic Prophecy. We'll look at what it says in the Bible and in the original Hebrew, and what we make of what it says, based on what it says. Then, what Jewish people, from pretty much Rashi and on, are saying it says, which is the opposite of what the Bible says. Not the opposite, but it went from a person to a people. It's not Jesus, it's not the Messiah, it's Israel. We'll go from what we know is the truth to what is being said today and believed by the Jewish community. And then, hopefully, we'll also see a way to counter that and to bring that back to the truth of the Bible. So sometimes we'll do maybe one or two messianic prophecy in a session, but those are fun to do because it's kind of like a lot of fun to study those. And so that's the part of the equipping that we'll do down the road. I'm trying to get you excited so you'll come back to the class, you know. So the Crusades. So one more word. Then Rashi Jewish people who study the Bible, being the Jewish Bible, of course, would be very uncomfortable studying it without Rashi's commentary. It would be the same if you were, as a believer today, you would find yourself studying your Bible but not being able to really do your devotion unless you would read the commentary by Charles Ryrie on the bottom. I have to know what Ryrie says because I'm not capable of understanding by myself, kind of like what the Catholic Church was used to. Like, we don't know how to make of the Bible. The Pope and the priest and all the different hierarchy of the Catholic Church, they tell us what to do. That's when they tell them. You know, most of the time it was in Latin, nobody understood. So that was, to this day, Jewish people still expect Rashi to tell them how to think. Of course, their rabbi will tell them how to think, but he learned from the writings of Rashi. So Rashi, extremely, extremely influential to this day. And we're looking at 10 centuries ago. So still going. Very much of an influence. And I mean, he's done a lot of good things, a lot of good writings. It's just like it's not God's inspired word. So 1096 is the first crusade. I don't know if I listed all the crusades, but we actually, I'm just going to go quickly here. The crusades were not originally organized to take, to get rid of the Jewish people. They were organized to push the infidels out of Jerusalem. The Crusaders went out of Europe all the way down to the Holy Land to push the Muslims away, and they realized, hey, you know what? Let's practice on the way down. We've got all kinds of Jews in the little villages of Europe, and we don't care for them anyway, so we might as well just practice on them. And there was even a motto, that was born: kill a Jew, save your soul. The Crusaders were going through the countryside of Europe, of France and Germany and Italy, and then they would go, kill a Jew, save your soul. The Crusades were not originally designed to fight the Jewish people, but why not? Since we're on our way, we might as well just take care of them as well. So the Crusades ended up being a very dark time for the Jewish people. Again, we have the crusader with the cross on the shield, and they arrive in Jerusalem. They put all the Jews they can find in the great synagogue of Jerusalem, put them inside, locked the doors, set the synagogue on fire, and this is historical record. You can find this anywhere. Put the synagogue on fire and march on their horses around the synagogue, chanting Christian hymns, and march on, Christian soldier, and then, I mean, I have people when I speak in churches, they come to me and they go, Olivier, why are you your people so stubborn? Why are they so against the gospel and the message? They're the people of the book. Of course, these people love the Jewish people. They want to see them come to Yeshua, which is great. It's wonderful. But they don't have a clue why my people are so stubborn, because they've been hurt in the name of Christ for two millennium. So you had a question? And then you have a question or comment.
Ladies first.
They've heard this before, but I became an atheist because I had seen them in the history books, and I was Catholic, and I thought, why would they kill Jews to make them come to Christ? It didn't make sense to me. And I knew other things about Catholicism. So God uses it in different ways for different people.
That's right.
The Crusades, I mean, you know, in fairness, you could probably have a class on that alone.
Oh, yeah.
But the Crusades were essentially called the start as a defensive action. For 400 years, beginning with approximately 711, Christian Europe had been attacked relentlessly by the Saracens, the Moors, the Muslims.
All kinds of, right.
So the reason why the Crusades were called were not necessarily, you know, to go out there and pull all the Muslims out of the Holy Land. They were being attacked both by land and sea. So, and what really triggered the Crusade was an attempted attack on Rome itself.
But that never justified the decimation of the Jewish people.
Well, I'm getting to that. Okay, so in order to raise an army, okay, the Crusaders had to sell it, and they went around the countryside promising all these people, come on, join a crusade, okay, and you're going to be able to get plunder and gold.
Uneducated masses joined, basically. Yeah.
So some of the people that were recruited to go on the crusades weren't of the best moral character.
Not that the contemporary Christian leaders were much better at the time, but I agree. And we talked a little more about that in the other class when we talk about the Crusades. The fact that was it Bernard de Clairvaux or the first couple of people that organized the Crusades, they were like, they grabbed whoever they could get to put an army together, and you know, like peasants, farmers, anybody like, hey, you wanna make a quick buck,
sure,
or a quick whatever it was. Come with us and join the army, and there's a prestige with it, and you know, bring loot back home, and then of course that, you know, the Jews got caught in the middle, right? So, well, you know, after the Crusades, it was all over. The Jews started to have a better life. Not after the Crusades, we have the Inquisition. You know, not much respite. The Inquisition, Spanish Inquisition. And again, I'm already spending more time than I need to on this because I'm giving you the notes. The Inquisition, the interesting story about the Inquisition and the decree that was issued in 1492 for all the Jews to leave Spain. What's interesting is that, based on Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless you, or curse him who curses you, we know that God always catches up with those who hurt the Jews. We've seen it with the Jews and Pharaoh. We've seen it with and the Pharaoh who did not, you know, who wanted to hurt the Jews, and then the Pharaoh who was who blessed Joseph. You know, you see the two sides of the coin, and then you see God catches up with Haman when, you know, he builds the gallows for Mordecai, and he's the one hanging on the gallows, curse for curse, and on and on and on throughout the Bible. It continues, it doesn't stop with the closing of the canon. It continues after the closing of the canon, and Spain is a very good example of that. In 1492, the decree that forced the Jews to leave Spain, of course, most people, when you tell them in America, you tell them 1492, you know, they finish the sentence, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, you know, and that's fine, that's true too. But in 1492, that's when Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand decided we want to get rid of the Jews. And secular history books all agree, but they don't really know. They can't put their finger on it. They all agree that Spain had been a wonderful empire with a lot of good things that happened out of Spain, great poets, great doctors, philosophers, artists, musicians for centuries prior to that, from like the 602 to that time. And then all of a sudden, 1492, they say 1492 was the beginning of the decline of the Spanish Empire as we knew it. It never recovered after that. And yet they can't put their finger on why. I tell you why.
No.
Genesis 12:3. That's it. I mean, it makes, to us, it's like a no-brainer. Of course, the world is going to laugh at us, but it's a no-brainer. You hurt the Jews, I'll catch up with you. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but I'll catch up with you. Okay? So we know that God is a God of covenant and promises, and he doesn't change. And we see it that way. Germany was divided in two after the war. For what, 40 years? East and West Germany with a lot of turmoil and a lot of death. So we see the two countries. Now, that's my interpretation, okay? So I want to take the blame for that one. My interpretation, because of what I'm studying on Sharia and Islam and what's happening in the world today, is that the two countries in Europe that have really done a lot of damage to the Jewish communities over, you know, the Middle Ages and all that time and all throughout, you know, the Holocaust are England and France. And today, the two countries of Europe that are the most affected by Islam are England and France. Not the only ones, but they're really affected by Islam. By far. I mean, so you know, I think, you know, maybe it's God telling them, oh, you want to mess with me? Well, you know what? I'm gonna let things happen over there. You're not gonna be a happy country. And things are getting really, it's getting, you know, from bad to worse right now. But that's Olivia commentary. The Spanish Inquisition. Then we have the first ghetto in Italy. A ghetto actually is Italian word for foundry. The foundry district is where the first ghetto was created. That's in 1516. There were good things about the ghetto, but for the most part, it was very good things that it kept. The Jewish community has always been one to like to stay together. So the ghetto, being together, was not a difficulty for the Jewish community, but being together, forced to be there in conditions that were really not good, that was a difficulty. And the model of the ghetto in Venice was picked up, of course, during the war in Lodz and Warsaw and different areas of Vilna in Lithuania, different areas of Europe and Eastern Europe. Then we go through the Reformation, Martin Luther and the Jews. I have a little test. I have a little seminar that I give when I visit churches, and then understand Jewish people and how to reach out to Jewish people. And I read what I put on the bottom of page 7 and page 8. First set fire to their synagogues or school, bury and cover them with dirt, whatever will not burn. Second, I'm just going to skip paragraphs, I advise that their house will be razed and destroyed for they pursue in them the same aims as the synagogues. Third, their prayer books and Talmudic writings would be, with such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught, be taken from them. Fourth, I advise that their rabbis be forbidden to teach. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highways be abolished. Advise six, that usury be prohibited to them. Seventh, I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a staff, or spindle into their hands. On and on and on. I read this whole thing in a church setting, and then I ask for a show of hands. And I say, if you know who wrote this, remain silent. But if you don't know who wrote this, give me your best guess of who you think wrote it. And every single time, there are several hands raised, and they say Hitler. And then I brace myself and I tell them, actually, it was Martin Luther. And I always get people first, the reaction is like, no. And I even get people after service coming to me and said, I don't believe you. They're like in a cognitive dissonance. I don't believe you. I said, well, go to the library, pull the whole complete work of Martin Luther, look for a book titled Of the Jews and Their Lies. It's there. Okay? If it's not there, you can get it on the web from any anti-Semitic groups, but I'd rather you go to a library and look at the works of Luther, because it carries more weight than getting it on a neo-Nazi or radical Islamist group. But it's what he wrote. Now, was Martin Luther an anti-Semite his whole life? Probably not. Has he not done anything good? No, he's done great. I mean, he's the father of the Reformation. We owe him quite a bit, okay? But we cannot be unaware of what he wrote against the Jewish people, because, my friends, my Jewish people, they know what Martin Luther wrote against the Jews. They'll tell you, what about Martin Luther? And you don't want to look back at your Jewish friends and say, what about him? He's the father of the Reformation. He's a great guy. Oh, yeah, well, you know, I happen to have a copy of a couple of pages of what he wrote, and there's more than what I just gave you in the notes here. And I have the whole booklet on the PDF if you're ever interested. And just email me. You have to be aware, because Jewish people tell you, like, you know, this is what he wrote. And Hitler actually said, I have it on the next page, it's in a book by Lucy Dewitowitz called The War Against the Jews, 1933-1945. She claimed that both Luther and Hitler were obsessed by the demonologized universe inhabited by the Jews. As a matter of fact, many scholars and historians believe that Luther's view of the Jews had a profound effect on Germans for centuries to come, and also had serious influence on Hitler's ideology in implementing the final solution of the Jewish question, the Holocaust. The link between Luther and Hitler is more obvious than one might think, and is very clear, at the very least, in a Jewish mindset. Okay, Hitler actually said, I'm only finishing what Luther started. He said that. Now, I don't think Luther would have said, you know what, hopefully one day somebody's going to pick up on what I read and what I wrote and just going to just destroy all the Jews. No, I don't think, I don't, you know, but we don't know what our actions are going to, you know, bring, you know, 10 years, 20 years after us, or a century, or, you know, when we're gone. We don't know. We have to be very careful. In a case like this, Hitler took it, ran with it, and just developed the concept to the level of the final solution. Well, there's a lot of people, you know, Martin Luther is a hero of the Reformation, a hero of the faith, and we cannot dismiss what he did. We cannot just, you know, throw the baby with the bathwater, was that what you say? We cannot completely ignore his place in history, but we have to know what he did because Jewish people know, and then it's part of the baggage of the church.
What did I know too?
Right. You know what? What goes on between God and Martin Luther is between God and Martin Luther. I agree with you, but I'm not going to get involved in that, because I have tried too many times to be God's assistant, and he doesn't need an assistant. So I've learned that way.
A lot of people reject the Bible with the 66 books in it because they think of Martin Luther.
I don't follow your logic here. But what's the link between the 66 books and Martin Luther? I still don't follow why they would even say that.
Because of the Catholic Bible.
They've added things that were not.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Catholic Bible, they've got, what, 7 extra books in the Apocrypha? Or I don't know how many, but... Yeah, well, if any Catholic tells you that is responsible for the King James Bible, you would have to tell them that he actually died 75 years before it was written. So, the King James was 1611 and he died in 1546. And Luther wrote in German, and the King James was was English Bible. So, but that's not even relevant to, you know. No. Yes.
Also, Martin Luther was not blessed after he wrote that booklet against the Jews.
Yeah,
he died shortly afterwards.
Right.
See,
I don't. I'm not arguing. You know that Martin Luther, but at the same time, you know, it's we walk as believers. We walk a very, very, very fine line, especially when we reach out to Jewish people. I am not going to throw out Martin Luther just to make a Jewish person happy, because that wouldn't be fair. That wouldn't be honest.
I agree. So, but if a Jewish person asked you about that, you could respond saying, "I don't think he was right. I don't think God is pleased with
it." Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. You could even add, you know, and he died very shortly after that, and who am I to judge or to know exactly what went on? But it's very possible, and it wouldn't be the first time that God followed through on his promise of Genesis 12:3 that he will bless those who bless the Jews and curse him who curses the Jew. And what I always like about in that verse is that the first part is plural, the second part is singular. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him. I mean, he'll come down to the very person who did something against the Jews, and you'll find them. Mm-hmm. You know, I will curse him who curses you. Right. So that's look at that. We're this is it. We know we caught up. You listen very fast, and we caught up. So do you have any more questions? Because we have a few more minutes.
So Maimonides wrote the Mishnah?
No. The Mishnah and the Gemara were written by a series of sages and rabbis.
Okay.
The Talmud, okay, the Talmud is made of two books. It's made of the Mishnah and the Gemara. And one, it started to be written in the Babylonian captivity of 557 BC, and that from that time on, they started to gather, you know, the research and the notes, and it did not get codified until 200 AD. So you're looking at almost 800 years later. So this is 800 years to 1,000 years later that it gets codified and written into books and volumes and tractates. The books are divided into different tractates. And then the Mishnah and the Gemara, the two different sections of the put together, are called the Talmud.
And at what point did they stop being added to, or are they still being added?
Well, there's two Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud was completed. It's done. It has never been. Nobody's added to. You can add commentaries. Here is my book. You know, like tomorrow, I could decide to write a commentary on Romans. It would be a commentary on the book of Romans. It wouldn't be another addition to the book, to the Bible. So more tons and tons and thousands of volumes have been written after the Talmud was finished, but the Babylonian Talmud, the one that was started in the Babylonian captivity, is finished. It's closed. It's complete. The Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, is unfinished and probably never will be finished. Most people today, when they study the Talmud, they study the Babylonian Talmud. Babylonian doesn't mean that it's got a Babylonian slant on it. It's simply where it was penned. That's it. We have a few more minutes, and if not, I don't want to start the third one because we're gonna finish. We're gonna do that next week, and then we'll be on track.
Yay.
That's wonderful. Let me go stop the thing.